So when I set this up, if you notice the little thing that I wrote, I put, Pastor Pam will join us. Guess what? She's not here.
She did last week. So.
She did. Well, I wanted someone to bail me out this week. Because as I put together kind of four things on death and dying and end-of-life conversations, I left this one as, I think I said death and spirituality. Because it sounded like a good topic at the time. So what do you think I'm going to talk about?
Death and dying.
What do you think I'm going to talk about when I say death and spirituality? Because I need some direction.
You need direction? Sorry, I couldn't reach that door.
Yeah, it's okay. Actually, as I've been thinking about it, and kind of batting it about in my head, I initially was going to tell stories, but if I tell stories for a half an hour, you're going to become very bored. So I wanted to kind of go back to a theme that I've got, and then at some point jump in and ask questions and kind of cover it. But I've been around hospice now since 2000. I'm not quite sure how I stumbled into it, but it was very much a stumbling. I had been without a job for, 4 or 5 months, and then an ad appeared in the paper looking for a hospice chaplain, and I wanted to be a hospital chaplain, but I figured I'll go apply. Well, it's 15 years later, and I'm still doing it. I also found out that the gentleman that was hired the next week is still in Milwaukee, still working for the same company I worked for when I was in Milwaukee. So, man, that's almost 30 years between the two of us. That's scary. But in that time, you know, people always ask me as a hospice chaplain, well, why are you so happy? You know, what isn't it a depressing thing? And as I've thought about it, you know, one of the jokes early on is I never told people I was a hospice chaplain at a party because they run away. Because death is contagious. So I told them I was a travel agent. I help people get from one place to the next.
That's a good analogy.
But there's a lot that I've seen, and I'm going to share some of what I've seen. But I think one of the important things to start out with, when you talk about death from a Christian perspective, I was going to talk about what some of the different religions think about death, but I started reading it and I went, man, this is boring. You know, I can tell you the Jehovah's Witnesses don't die. They go into a state of unconsciousness because at the end they're all raised up, 144,000 to heaven, the rest to paradise on earth. So they don't really die. So I'm thinking I might convert. You know, and I've seen a lot of things. The B'nai faith, which I know very little about. When a B'nai dies, there's a certain orientation that they turn the deathbed to. And B'nai are usually buried within one day of death, as close to the death as possible to the place they physically die. Generally, they try to get them within a mile of where they die. You know, so if you want to start looking at death customs across faith traditions, it's incredible. When an Orthodox Jew dies, you cover any mirrors in the house, in the room. Any water gets dumped out. And there's reasons for that I can't remember. They're also buried. They try to bury them within 24 hours. When an Orthodox Jew dies, there's always someone with the body. The body is never left alone until it's buried. You know, so there's... You can start doing that. It's fun stuff to look at all the different things. But one of the things for me that really strikes me is I talk about death and dying. And from Romans today, I mean, this just hit me. We've been buried with Christ by baptism into death, so that just as Christ was raised from the dead by the glory of the Father, so we too might walk in newness of life. For if we've been united with him in a death like his, we will certainly be united with him in a resurrection like his. So as Christians, what do we believe is going to happen to us when we die? What lies after death?
Dirt in your face.
What?
Dirt in your face.
Dirt in your face. But what lies after death for us? What's our hope as Christians?
Heaven.
Heaven and the resurrection. Yeah. And so we got the soul and we got heaven. And yes, I don't write as pretty as Pastor Pam, sorry.
But you're left-handed, that's so good.
Yeah, well, we're the only people in our right mind.
Yes.
And so one of the things that I've encountered along the way as I've done the work that I've done is you have very faithful people. I mean, people with incredibly deep faith. And as I encounter them, if you know where you're going to go after you die, should you be afraid? No. No, you shouldn't be afraid if you know that at death your soul is going to be in heaven. You know, that should not be a fearful thing. Yet I see a lot of fear. And one of the things that I'm learning and I'm discerning is that the physical process of dying is what causes people fear. Because how many times do you die?
Once.
How many of you have died? How many of you know what it's going to be like? How many of you have watched someone with an extended illness die? You know, how does that usually end? Is it a peaceful thing?
They look peaceful.
Mm-hmm. They look very peaceful. As long as you've got people around you that provide the right support and the right care, it's generally a very peaceful thing. But again, we only experience it once. And so I think a lot of times when people talk about a fear of death, they're really more talking about a fear of what's going to happen to the body. What's it going to go through? What's going to happen? Am I going to be comfortable? Am I not going to be comfortable? And I think that can cause a lot of fear in people. And one of the things that comes with that is, you know, if you're afraid of the process of dying, one of the things that I see is sometimes what that can do then is bring a level of doubt into what's going on. You know, think about it. We all believe that we're going to go to heaven when we die, but boy, as soon as we start doubting that process of dying, you know, then we start doubting what comes after death. And I think that's where some of the fear comes in that I've seen and experienced.
If you're experiencing a debilitating illness, I think that is a worse thought process for me than the actual death.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like cancer or...
Yeah.
Kind of a lingering illness.
Yeah. And why do you think that is?
I think that's the human part of us, because we're kind of geared to, you know, hang on to life.
Yeah.
That's a human part of it.
Yeah, we're geared to hang on, to grasp life, what, you know, live every day. You know, the fight to live is so much something that's a part of us. I think we have very poor education, which is why what I've been doing to me is so important. We have very poor education about different diseases and what they do to the body. I think that's part of it too. But yeah, I think there's also that, you know, we're programmed to hold on to life. And that's where, you know, the kind of struggle between dying and death for me comes in. Because again, as Christians, if we die and we know that when we die we go to heaven, why do we fight so hard to hold on to life? You know, what do people think about that?
Well, you don't want to prematurely end your life.
Right, right.
I consider that not a good thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know if God considers that a sin or not, but well, I think of it as a sin.
Yeah. But a lot of the questions we ask today, they weren't asking 100 years ago. Think about that. A lot of the questions we ask about how we die today, they weren't asking 100 years ago. You know, 100 years ago, were people getting tube fed?
Getting what?
Tube feeding.
Yeah.
You know, pull old death certificates. What did people die from? Consumption. What was it? Stomach cancer. That's a big one on old death certificates, because any cancer in here was stomach cancer. They didn't have the diagnostic technology to know exactly what was going on.
Yeah, they didn't know if it was liver or...
Right. Right. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, one of the things that I always struggle with is as technology is advanced, it allows us to live longer. But I think, was it you, Gwen, that asked the question a couple of weeks ago about what about dying in God's time?
Yeah. I want to die in His rather than
something
man-made.
And that's a real struggle, you know, to ask. And it's very hard, you know, because again, if the technology didn't exist, there are questions we're not asking, you know. And I can tell you, you know, a lot of things that I've seen. The one thing that I've seen is that really the process of dying, of death, you have to have a body ready and you have to have a spirit ready. You have to have the body ready and the spirit ready. Now, and you know, unless there's an accident. But I even had the first grief group I did back in West Bend. I had something remarkable that just blew my mind. This woman came in, she had lost her 23-year-old son. He was in an industrial accident. He was working in a hole in the ground as a sewer mechanic or whatever, cutting pipe, and the saw blade slipped and sliced him. And, you know, they did what they could. He died. You know, I talk about the body and the spirit being ready. Well, there's a process that I see a lot in what we call expected death. You know, I've got a book that says you're going to see this at 3 months, you're going to see this at 2 months. And there's a process, people withdraw and there's different things they do. Well, this 23-year-old had put together a scrapbook of his life at 23. And as I started talking to this mother, what just boggled my mind is when I looked at that timeline, there were a number of things in that timeline that he did right in order. I don't think he had any idea that he was going to die, but somehow in his spirit, I think he was preparing. You know, it's really strange. But, you know, that's one of the things that I've seen, and for me, it keeps me going to work every day because I never know what I'm going to see. I don't know if I shared the story about this little old lady early on in my work, but they called me and they said, "You got to do something, Chaplain." I said, "Why?" They said, "Well, she won't die." I said, "Okay." And she started saying, "I'm sorry." And here's this lady who's been unconscious for 7 days, and about every 2 minutes she just says, "I'm sorry." And so they said, "You got to fix it." And so on the way down, I called the family, and I said, "Okay, what's she sorry for?" They said, "We have no clue." I said, "Is there some, you know, is there some deep, dark secret? Are there illegitimate children? You know, was there a traveling salesman?" And, you know, we kind of, because I'm thinking, what at this point, you know, when her body is worn out, is troubling her spirit so much, she's saying, "I'm sorry." And I talked to the family, and there was nothing that any of them knew. There was nothing that they could think of that would be that troubling for her. So I remember going down to the nursing home, and I had my little green occasional services book, and I opened it up, and I don't know how many of you know that Lutherans actually have an individual order for confession and forgiveness. You know, just like the Catholics, we can do confession and forgiveness. And so I pulled out my book, and I went through the order for confession and forgiveness with her. The only thing is she was unconscious. So when I got to the parts where she was supposed to speak, I said something like, "Okay, now in your heart, you know." And I gave her some times of silence, and I read what would be, you know, her request for absolution, and said, "If you agree, you know, in your heart, say yes." Went through the whole thing as a called and ordained minister of the Church of Christ, and by His authority, I therefore declare to you the entire forgiveness of all of your sins, in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Said the Lord's Prayer, and guess what she stopped saying?
Sorry.
It stopped. And half an hour later, they called me and said, "She died." Now, I have absolutely no idea what was troubling her in her spirit. But, I mean, that, whatever it was keeping her from death. And that was the day they almost took away my job, because I went from there to another family. And there was a gentleman with severe COPD, and you could see he was on his way out. And they were Episcopal, and that's about the time that the Episcopals and Lutherans started talking to each other. And so my first comment was, has your priest been here? Yes. Did he give you the sacrament of the sick? Yes. Okay. Anything else you can think of? No. And I said, oh, did he celebrate the Eucharist with you? And they said, no. I said, as a family, would you like to celebrate the Eucharist? They said, yes. So we got around his bed, and we celebrated the sacrament of Holy Communion. He took the bread, and he took the wine. And after that, you could see an incredible peace in him and in his family. And it was about 10 minutes later, and he was gone. That's when my boss wasn't happy with me. Two in one day hurt the senses. But there was an incredible peace that came. You know, whatever it was in his case, sharing the sacrament of Holy Communion brought him peace. You know, and that's what, you know, is so interesting when we think about this. You know, when it comes to the end of life, I think God does give us a level of control. I'm not going to say God's not in control, but I think God gives us, and sometimes, a window. And it's so important to know that you've got to be ready, body and soul. You know, I don't know how many times I've seen a body that should be gone that isn't, because there's something holding the soul. You know, and the flip side is, there have been times when I've seen people die and I'm like, that should not have happened. Their body's not that sick. But somehow the soul is ready. And it's just, it's a very interesting dance to watch. And you guys are going, he's nuts.
Maybe that's why accidents happen. Maybe the soul is ready.
Could be. You know, who knows? That could very well be, you know.
Well, what's your opinion about near-death experiences?
Well, and that's where the other place I wanted to go, because what's very interesting is when I was in college, I picked up, well, this is kind of post-death, but I picked up a book called Giants in the Earth by Ole Rolvag. He was a Norwegian immigrant novelist. And he wrote about farming on the plains in Dakota. And in his novel, his wife was a very spiritually connected person. And there were multiple times in the novel where his wife would be in bed and somebody would be sitting at the bedside. And it would be somebody from the old country, and she knew when she saw that person that they had died. And they had come to her to say goodbye. And then about 3 weeks later, she would get the letter that had a black outline on the envelope, which meant somebody died. And it was always the person she had seen. Now, you know, did he make this stuff up or not? Well, I haven't done the study, but somebody did, and they said if you read immigrant novels and if you look at some of the archives along the East Coast and along the Midwest, that's a universal experience among immigrants. People who never talked to each other, cultures who never interacted, having someone come to them at the time of death was a universal experience across cultures. You know, and for me, that was a real eye-opener. Because I think we get this idea that when we die, you know, the gate to heaven opens up, we slip through and it slams shut. I mean, that's what I got all my training in seminary for, right? But I think when I look at death and spirituality, I think it's much bigger, and I think that's where this near-death stuff you're talking about comes in. Are you talking about the people who see themselves floating in the room? Mm-hmm. You know, I had a lady once in a bed in the hospital, and she was dying, and it's so funny because she said to the nurse, oh, there's a spider. And the nurse said, oh, honey, that's the morphine. Morphine will make you see bugs. No, there's a spider. No, honey, it's the... This went on for about 2 minutes. The nurse turned around and screamed because there was a spider. And I say that because a lot of times, you know, we try to say these near-death experiences are the result of medications that people are taking, or, you know, loss of oxygen or something like that. But again, if you look at them across a broad sweep, how many times are the experiences the same? You know, there is some sense that I've seen that, I mean, if we're really beings that are both spiritual and physical, there is a sense that there can be a separation at some point. You know, I don't know that all the people that talk about them have really experienced them, but I never discount them. I had a lady once, oh, she was so sweet. She was 96. She was this little old African-American lady. I remember it was her birthday, and we said, what do you want for your birthday? And she said, Jack. And I said, Jack who? She said, Jack Daniels. And so we brought her, you know, we all brought her a little fifth, and her daughter was appalled that this good Christian lady wanted Jack. Well, she drank a shot a night. That was her, you know, she was from Tennessee. She'd done that for years. The daughter came around because as mom was dying, she was swabbing her mouth with Jack. So, but she was an incredibly delightful woman. I remember one day she was having trouble. She was in that transitioning part of her disease process, and she just wouldn't settle down. And I spent an hour with her, and all I did was sing, read from the Psalms, and pray. Just kind of a cycle. And that brought her to some peace. But as she was getting toward the end one day, she said, Chaplain, I don't know what to do. And I said, what do you mean? She said, I keep falling asleep. I go down this tunnel, and there's a light at the end of the tunnel. But before the light, there's a table. And there's 2 men at the table, and there's a great big book, and they keep saying, is your name in the book? And she said, I don't know what to tell them, so I keep coming back. And I said, oh, honey, that's the book of life. That's the kingdom of heaven. You're one of God's children. You know that. God loves you. You're one of God's children. Your name is in God's book of life. So next time you get down there, say, yes, I'm in the book of life. Well, I'm guessing she did, because the next time she went unconscious, she died within hours. You know. So, I mean, that's a near-death experience. Was she really going down a tunnel, seeing the book of life and coming back? What do you think?
I think so.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, she believed it.
Yeah.
She believed it. And whatever I said gave her the peace to go beyond. You know, I'm not that intelligent. God puts those words in my mouth at those times. I mean, I know that.
What about people that are killed in an accident or something like that, die immediately? They have no chance to make things right?
Well, but I think the important thing to remember is that, you know, as Lutheran Christians, we believe it isn't about us making things right with God, it's about how God has made things right with us. And that's first and foremost what it always is that God has made things right with us through the life and death and resurrection of our Lord Jesus Christ. You know, so that's a different perspective as how we look at it. They don't necessarily have the time to prepare the soul, but the other thing is we haven't been in that position, so we don't know what happens. You know, I know suicide is a very difficult thing, a very controversial thing. I know that in some traditions, they will not bury a suicide out of the church. I know that in some traditions, they won't bury a suicide in the church cemetery, because they believe that in taking one's life, you are committing the ultimate sin. But the flip side is, you know, you don't know what the state of mind of someone is just before they die, do you? You know? And so that's a real struggle, you know? We know that in the scripture, God doesn't say anything about that. God doesn't say, if you kill yourself, you're going to go to hell. And so another thing as Lutherans, we believe, boy, man, all my seminaries coming back to me, this is scary. But we believe in the God who is hidden and the God who is revealed. So God is revealed to us through the pages of Scripture, through the stories in the Bible. The God that we know is Jesus Christ, who said, love your neighbor, you know, love God. And that's the God that we know, you know. That's the God that says all who believe and are baptized will see salvation. Well, what does God say about those who are not baptized in the Scriptures? Absolutely nothing. There's not a single word in the Scriptures about what happens to the unbaptized. The Catholic Church has a wonderful tradition about what happens. There's this thing called limbo, where you're good enough to get to limbo but not get to heaven because you weren't baptized. Well, from what we know about a gracious, loving God, would God condemn someone to separation of God forever just because they weren't baptized? What does the God that we know teach us? You know, and that's what we talk a lot about as Lutherans. What does the God we know teach us about, you know? So that goes back to your question, Ray, you know. If somebody dies in an accident, do they have time to make things right with God? Well, what do we know about God? Grace and love and forgiveness, right? You know, so that's kind of the lens at which I, through, you know, which I look at a lot of these things. You know, that's why as I've been doing the work I've been doing, my mind has been so opened up, because, you know, I don't know how many times I walk into a room and someone will say, "Chaplain, Mom's crazy, and Mom's the one dying." I'll say, "Why is Mom crazy?" "Well, she's talking to people. She's talking to Dad." And so I will immediately say, "Dad's dead." And they're like, "How did you know that?" And I'll say, "And she was looking in the corner when she was talking to Dad, and she was going like that. How did you know that?" It's a very universal experience. The number of times that I will be with someone who is talking to someone that I can't see, and even stranger than that is the number of times I'm with someone who's talking in the language of their childhood, be it German or Swedish or Norwegian, to people I can't see. It happens so many times. And it's an incredible thing to see. And I, you know, think part of it is we get in these little boxes where we don't open our minds to the possibilities. You know, because as I said earlier, I think it would be so nice if when we died, the gate to heaven opened and then it slammed shut, we got through. But the more that I see this, the more that, you know, this is almost, is this heresy, Myrna? You're going to have to check me. That the gate to heaven is a two-way gate. And there are times that people that we love come back to bring us into heaven. I mean, whether that happens or not, I won't know till I get there. But the number of times I've seen that, it's incredible. You know, think about experiences you've had. You know, do you know, did Russell talk to people?
No.
Oh, he didn't much. Okay. Does anybody know of being with someone who was talking to people? Yeah, and who were they talking to?
People that are deceased.
Yeah. Yeah, and was it scary poltergeist, head spinning, green vomit stuff?
No, we couldn't see.
Right. Right, but it was always, the conversation was always peaceful, and there was always a sense of peace around it, wasn't there? Yeah. Yeah. You know, so when I talk about not fearing death, you know, that's a lot of what I have in my perspective from that. You know. The other thing that I've seen, and this is even stranger, and I don't know if any of you have had these experiences, but I know that when my mother-in-law died, Christina told us. Christina knew, and she told us before we got the phone call. She knew. I don't know how many times I've been with a family, somebody's driving in from Peoria, my brother's coming, Mom just died, what should I do? Well, you know your brother better than I do. If you call him, are you going to upset him? Yes. Okay, don't call him. But if he gets here and can tell you when Mom died, don't be surprised. You know how many times a brother walks in and says, "Oh, sis, I'm so sorry. I know that Mom died 20 minutes ago. I wish I could have been here." And they're spot on. Yeah. Yeah, I actually one night, Pam's poking me going, "One of the kids is in the hallway." And I'm going, "It's 3 a.m. Let him be." "No, no." So I go and I look and they're both sound asleep. And I said, "Oh, that's one of my patients. They came to say goodbye." And so we went back to bed. The next morning, we had what we called the death line at my old office, and you called it up to find out who died. And I thought there was a patient I'd been working very close with, but within 2 minutes of that, whatever it was that woke Pam up, one of our patients had died. And it was one where I'd been talking to the husband that morning at length. And he was a man of, claimed to be of no faith. And I was telling him that sometimes we get a sign from people after they've died. We may see them or experiencing them. And, you know, he was telling me that would never happen. But he also made the comment that from some of the other things I was saying, you know, I bet your wife and my wife would have been good friends in life. And so within 2 minutes of her dying, my wife saw her in our house. You know, have any of you had an experience where someone you love has died and you've had some sense that they've come back?
I've had a dream.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very, very vivid. I remembered it for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah.
After Russell passed away, I'd wake up with the same dream for several nights. He was standing in the cemetery calling for me to come and get him.
Oh. Interesting. Interesting. Other experiences?
My cousin was killed in Vietnam, and his dad was wearing his watch. And the watch suddenly wouldn't work, and it was set at a certain time. That was when he died. So it's just weird. And my brother woke up and said something's wrong with him, and he was right.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And I don't say this to make people cry. I know it brings back a lot of memories and I'm seeing a lot of tears. But, you know, what I find out is that people, when I do this with confirmation kids, they're afraid to tell those stories. You know, because what happens if you tell a story like that to kids? What do they say? They tell you you're what?
Crazy.
You're crazy. Yeah.
Because I haven't lived long enough to maybe have.
But I was in a group of 30 confirmation kids, and I started telling stories, and by the time we were done, over half had had an experience of someone after they died that they'd never told anyone about because they were afraid. They were afraid their friends would say they were nuts. So they never shared the stories. You know? Again, this is one of those things that's beyond me. Does it happen? I mean, think about that. You know, does it really happen? You know, I never discount it when I hear it. I never discount it when I hear it because I think, you know, I just don't want to be in that position of discounting it for someone else. Because I've seen so many things, I just can't, you know, I can't say it didn't happen. Other thoughts and questions or experiences or...
Question.
Mm-hmm.
When somebody's dying and they're relating to somebody that's passed away, should you correct them or just go right with them?
Go with the flow. Go with the flow, yes. Yeah, it's just like when you're dealing with someone who's demented. Mm-hmm. Go with the flow. You know, granted you're not outside at the Cubs game at Wrigley Field, but you know, or whatever it is. But I think it's very important to go with the flow because whatever they're experiencing is real for them. You know, we can't experience it, but it's real for them. You know, one of the first ladies that I ever took care of that died, she was very demented, but she was smart enough to know this was that when the pastor came, you had pie. And that when the pastor came, you got communion. And when the pastor came, you said the Lord's Prayer. So I would go and I would, you know, try to do a little communion service with her. And inevitably, she'd just start saying the Lord's Prayer. So no matter where we were, we said the Lord's Prayer. Then she had communion, then she always tried to give me pie. There was no pie, but I took the pie. You know, interestingly enough, the last time I saw her, her family was with me. And she started saying something, and I was completely lost. And I looked, and the son said, oh, that's the Lord's Prayer in Norwegian, where she had learned it originally. You know, so in her dementia, in her moving toward death, she actually kind of went back in life to the point where she was in Norwegian and not English. You know. So, yeah, go with them, you know. And a lot of times, they may not even know. They may not recognize that you're trying to talk to them either, but, you know, just kind of go with them.
My mother worked with a group for a while that was called Spiritual Frontiers, And it was, because she had times when somebody would appear to her. And she would sometimes be sitting at the table and suddenly her hand was writing. And she wasn't writing it. It was just, you know, she had a pen or a pencil and she was writing. And many times it was somebody that was sending a message to their family. It wasn't necessarily, it wasn't our family, but to their family, to let them know they were okay.
Yeah.
And they would disclose things in the message sometimes that no one else knew. And she said, I don't understand this message, but I got it and I was supposed to deliver it to, like, somebody that lived 10 miles away. And she said, I don't know what it means. And they looked at it and they said, oh, well, yeah, she's talking about such and such. And so she went to these workshops because she wanted to know a little bit more about it and discovered that many people had that gift. And it's not something you try to have.
Kind of like that.
Kind of like the medium.
Show the medium.
In a way.
Yeah.
I mean,
those things make me a little bit leery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, because I read Elmer Gantry,
yeah.
You know, and,
yeah.
And they make me a little leery because sometimes they seem too staged.
Yeah.
You know.
And they're profiting by it on TV.
Yeah, they're profiting by it on TV.
But this was something she just, you know, she never knew when it happened. It didn't happen very often.
Right.
It happened a couple times,
three times. I mean, I think what's so hard for us to grasp is the fact that we do live in a physical world and in a spiritual world, and we're very in tune to the physical world. But that spiritual world, we're not as in tune to. You know, I used to tell people I did exorcisms, and they looked at me like, what do you mean? Well, but I can remember a handful of times when I went into a house where someone was dying, and the family just said, the presence of evil is here. We have to do something. This just doesn't feel right. And I'm like, oh boy, you know, should I call a priest? No. But, you know, what we would do then in those cases is in prayer, we would acknowledge that the forces of darkness and evil are real in this world. And we would pray that God would remove them from that place. And I don't remember exactly the prayers I said or what I did, but, you know, that's kind of thing that I would do. It, not a lot, but every time I did it, the family would say that they felt the presence of evil leave. And I think part of it's because we acknowledged it. You know, when you acknowledge the spiritual side, when you point it out, you know, then you can see it. And like I said, with it was strange. I never questioned anybody when they said they felt the presence of evil. I just did what they asked me to do. You know, but there are people who are much more in tune to that spiritual side, and see that. You know, I had a gentleman who. His wife died and he talked to her every night. And I mean physically talked to her. And she physically answered. And he was in a grief group and up toward the end he said, you know, last Saturday night, she said, I'm done. She said, you're where you need to be. I don't need to talk to you anymore. You know, see you later in heaven kind of thing. That was a lady who, when she died, the family wanted a sign that she was okay. And I was there, and it's still to this day, the entire house filled with the smell of roses. Now, it was significant because they were Roman Catholic, and they were both very strong in their devotion to the Blessed Virgin Mary. And what flower belongs to the Blessed Virgin Mary? The rose. There was no potpourri, there was no room spray, there was nothing. You know, again, something very peaceful. So, any other thoughts or words or questions?
We went to a funeral, a young lady with the funerals for a young lady we knew, and she had cancer, she's dying of cancer, and she just keep living on. And finally, the pastor related to this. He said, I told her, Marcia, you've got to let go. Gotta let go. So he talked to him
and
she died.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't know how many times I've been with a family and I've learned to say if you can tell them that you're gonna be okay, tell them. Or if you can tell them to let go, tell them. You know, because people need to hear that. They need to know it's okay. I've also been on the opposite side of the room where I walk in and they call me because, well, he's been here for a week and he won't die. Okay. And I walk in and it's like this. The only difference is there's a bed in the middle and we're all leaning in going, Dad, it's okay to die. And I'll start talking to the family and I'll say, oh, Mr. Schmidt, Wilhelm, he's German, isn't he? Yeah. You know, Germans, they're kind of stubborn and pig at it, aren't they? Yeah, almost as bad as Swedes. So when Dad was alive, if you told him what to do, what did he do?
The opposite.
The opposite. And then I just leave it. And pretty soon the family looks at me and they go, oh my. And then I learned to redirect them, to talk about Dad's life, to talk about what Dad did, to talk about... And it would be remarkable how often within the next 10, 15 minutes he would just slip away. Or she would just slip away, you know. Again, that's something that teaches me, you know, how much there is about the spirit and the body being ready. You know, I learned, people say, well, you know, I got to stay with him. I don't want him to be alone when he dies. Well, there are some people that have to die alone. You know, you start talking to a family in depth and... You know, question I always ask is, where was he at Thanksgiving time, or where was she? Oh, Mom was always at Thanksgiving. She was always the center of attention. She was, you know, the kids were all around her. That's why around her. And you start talking, well, where was Mom? She was in the kitchen cooking. Did she sit down to eat? No. She was always off by herself. So as she approaches death, is she going to be more likely to be off by herself or want the whole family around? You know, and it starts to be interesting when you start talking to people about these things. What I learned early on is people die the way they lived. You know, I had a couple that was married 75 years and the family said, he's not going to die if we're here. And guess what they did? They never let him alone. The rabbi came, they had prayer, and the nurses said, we need 2 minutes alone with him. We need you to step out so we can change him and give him some medicine. Guess when he died? In the 2 minutes, yeah. Yeah.
So. Some doctors must have a hard time with patients, you know, that they know they can't help, and it would be a tough racket, I think.
I think it is for doctors, because I think a lot of them see death as a defeat. Mm-hmm. They're trained to heal. You know, but I think what's missing a lot with doctors is they don't get a lot of training in the spiritual part of life. You know, they try to fix the body, but they don't understand that there's a soul that goes with it. And I know, yeah, I mean, I had a doctor when I was in Milwaukee, and I had brown hair before I met him. Not quite, but we would get patients, and the first thing I learned to ask a patient and family was, what has the doctor told you about your illness? Every single one of his family said, well, the doctors told us that, you know, Mom's going to be around. He can't do anything else. She's got at least 6 months and maybe a year or more. Not a single one of his patients made it past 21 days. Because that was his issue. He treated as long as he could. Then he gave them to us. And so as a team, we knew we had 21 days to take a family from a year to weeks. You know, but that was all about the doctor, because he couldn't admit, you know.
Well, what I mean is, most doctors, I think, are like their patients, and they hate to see them die.
Yeah.
And I think they
yeah.
try.
Yeah.
You know, you can't do it all, but...
Yeah.
It'd be hard to see a good... Especially if you're a friend of the patient.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're not supposed to get attached as a medical professional to any of your patients. But you do, you know, and I think that's why back to the first, you know, couple of weeks, those conversations we have with our doctors are so important about what we want and about what's important to us. Because I think sometimes that gives a doctor permission to say, okay, you know, I understand. Yeah, well, you know, small towns, I grew up, there was one doctor in the town for 30 years. You know?
Yeah. He's seen a lot of his friends die, didn't he?
Yep. Yeah.
It's also really hard on pastors.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the longer you're in a congregation, the more people that you really care for die.
Yeah.
And sometimes we need to think of the pastor and minister to the pastor.
Yeah.
Because they're the ones that are constantly ministering to parishioners. But sometimes we have to reciprocate because it's just as hard for them, maybe even harder for them to lose a really good friend who is a member of the congregation who they've served for a long time. And yet they have to deal with it.
Yeah.
So we need to really be careful of that and make sure that our pastors always have a chance to.
I think it was hard for Pastor Pam that week. She lost three. It was like going to their funeral Sunday. It was a beautiful, beautiful sermon. But I thought, who's helping her get through this?
Well, and I'm not telling on her if I tell a story. maybe I'm telling on her. Yeah. I got a debate here. Well, part of it is, though, on two of those deaths, there was a little involvement that I had that helped her. Because there were some questions and some things, and she will ask me about hospice and about end-of-life stuff when she doesn't understand, and I've learned rather than just talking to her on the phone, if I've got a minute, I'll go, because it's much easier to interact with families than that. But I think it was Thursday, I said, if you want me to, I'll preach on Sunday, because you've had a heck of a week. And she said yes, and about 10 minutes later, she texted me and said, no, I have to. You know, I have to. And that's the sermon you heard. And, you know, she texted me and she said, this is why I have to. And I said, oh, your sermon's already written for Sunday.
That was the most beautiful service I think I'd ever been to.
Yeah.
We all had tears.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and, you know, part of it is when you think about, I was just telling somebody, I think there was 190 years of marriage between the three of them. But it isn't even that. You look at the faith history of those people. You know, again, that's where the soul and the heaven side is so important for me. You look at the faith history of those people and the fact that they have ties back in this congregation forever. But, you know, more so that, again, you know, we talk in the Lutheran Church about the communion of saints. Everybody who's died and gone before us. You know, they're part of that great communion of saints, that great cloud of witnesses. We're never alone. You know, when we're sitting in church with 40 people, we're never alone because there's that whole cloud of witnesses that's up there. You know, and I think that helps. But yeah, pastors do need ministry. You know, I know that going to Joplin, though it's a lot of driving, is very helpful.
Yeah.
You know, very physical, putting something together.
For somebody.
Yeah.
In a different sense.
Yeah. Yeah, I told her she could have mowed the lawn. That didn't work.
Good try.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if there's more questions or more things, I'm more than happy to talk. I think she's probably telling me, okay, it's past time. Make sure you're done.
Is it?
No, she's passing through Lebanon.